The following program is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello and welcome to the fifth reading of Camino Island by John Grisham. I'm Rosina Chevalier. Before we begin, let me explain that this book is read in its entirety. However, some of the reading may still contain explicit descriptions that some people may find objectionable. For those of you who did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. Mercer eventually agrees to do this job. The insurance company pays off her student debt in addition to the lump sum they promised. She moves into the cottage and gets detailed instructions from Elaine about what they want her to do. Now we continue with Camino Island. The Dumbarton Gallery was a block off Wisconsin Avenue in Georgetown. It was a small gallery on the ground floor of an old red brick townhouse, one in need of a good paint job and perhaps a new roof. Despite the heavy foot traffic only a block away, the gallery was usually deserted, its walls practically bare. It specialized in minimalist modern stuff that evidently wasn't too popular, at least not in Georgetown. Its owner didn't really care. His name was Joel Ribicoff, 52 years old and a convicted felon, busted twice for dealing in stolen valuables. His art gallery on the first floor was a front, a ruse designed to convince anyone who might be watching, and after two convictions and 8 years in the slammer, Joel believed that someone was always watching, that he had gone straight and was now just another struggling gallery owner in Washington. He played the game, had some shows, knew a few artists and even fewer clients, and half-heartedly maintained a website, again for the benefit of watchful eyes. He lived on the third floor of the townhouse. On the second, he had his office, where he tended to his serious business, that of brokering deals for stolen paintings, prints, photographs, books, manuscripts, maps, sculpture, and even forged letters, allegedly written by famous dead people. Even with the horrors of two convictions and life in prison, Joel Ribicoff simply could not stick to the rules. For him, living in the underworld was far more exciting and profitable than minding a small gallery and pushing art few people wanted. He loved the thrill of connecting thieves to their victims, or thieves to intermediaries, and structuring deals that involved multiple layers and parties, with the valuables moving in the dark as money was wired to offshore accounts. He rarely took possession of the loot, but preferred to be the savvy middleman who kept his hands clean. The FBI had stopped by a month after the Fitzgerald heist at Princeton. Of course, Joel knew nothing. A month later, they were back, and he still knew nothing. After that, though, he learned a lot. Fearing the FBI had tapped his phones, Joel had disappeared from the D.C. area and went under deep cover. Using prepaid and disposable cell phones, he had made contact with the thief and had met him at an interstate motel near Aberdeen, Maryland. The thief had introduced himself as Denny, and his accomplice was Rooker. A couple of tough guys. On a cheap bed, in a double room that was worth $79 a night, Joel took a look at the five Fitzgerald manuscripts that were worth more than any of the three could imagine. It had been obvious to Joel that Denny, undoubtedly the leader of the gang, or what was left of it, was under enormous pressure to unload them and flee the country. "I want $1 million," he said. I can't find that much, Joel had replied. I have one and only one contact who will even talk about these books. All the boys in my business are extremely spooked right now. The feds are everywhere. My only deal is $500,000. Denny had cursed and stomped around the room, pausing occasionally to peek through the curtains and glance at the parking lot. Joel got tired of the theatrics and said he was leaving. Denny finally caved, and they completed the details. Joel left with nothing but his briefcase. After dark, Denny left with the manuscripts and instructions to drive to Providence and wait. Rooker, an old army pal who had also turned to crime, met him there. 3 days later, and with the assistance of another intermediary, the transfer had been completed. Now Denny was back in Georgetown with Rooker and looking for his treasure. Ribicoff had given him a good screwing the first time around. It would not happen again. As the gallery was closing at 7 p.m. on Wednesday, May 25th, Denny walked in its front door while Rooker pried open a window to Joel's office. When all the doors were locked and all the lights were off, they carried Joel to his apartment on the third floor, bound and gagged him, and began the ugly business of extracting information. Chapter 4. The Beachcomber. With Tessa, the day began with the sunrise. She would drag Mercer out of bed and hurry to the deck, where they sipped coffee and waited with great anticipation for the first glimpse of the orange glow rising on the horizon. Once the sun was up, they would hustle down the boardwalk and check out the beach. Later in the morning, as Tessa worked in the flower beds on the west side of the cottage, Mercer would often ease back into bed for a long nap. With Tessa's consent, Mercer had had her first cup of coffee around the age of 10 and her first martini at 15. Everything in moderation was one of her grandmother's favorite sayings. But Tessa was gone now, and Mercer had seen enough sunrises. She slept until after 9 and reluctantly got out of bed. As the coffee brewed, she roamed around the cottage in search of the perfect writing space and didn't find one. She felt no pressure and was determined to write only if she had something to say. Her novel was 3 years past due anyway. If they could wait for 3 years in New York, then they could certainly handle 4. Her agent checked in occasionally, but with less frequency. Their conversations were brief. During her long drives from Chapel Hill to Memphis to Florida, she had loafed and dreamed and plotted and at times felt as though her novel was finding its voice. She planned to toss the scraps that she'd already written and start over, but this time with a serious new beginning. Now that she was no longer in debt and no longer worried about the next job, her mind was wonderfully uncluttered with the nagging irritations of everyday life. Once she was settled and rested, she would plunge into her work and average at least 1,000 words a day. But for her current job, the one for which she was being handsomely paid, she had no idea what she was doing and no idea how long it might take to do whatever she was supposed to do, so she decided there was no benefit in wasting a day. She went online and checked her emails. Not surprisingly, ever-efficient Elaine had dropped a note during the night with some useful addresses. Mercer typed an email to the Queen Bee. Dear Myra Beckwith, I'm Mercer Mann, a novelist, house-sitting on the beach for a few months while I work on a book. I know virtually no one here, and so I'm taking a chance by saying hello and suggesting we, you, Miss Train, and me, get together for a drink. I'll bring a bottle of wine. At 10 on the dot, the doorbell rang. When Mercer opened the front door, an unmarked box was on the porch, but there was no delivery guy in sight. She took it to the kitchen table, where she opened and unpacked it. As promised, there were the four large picture books by Noel Bonnet, three novels by Serena Roach, the rather slim literary edition by Lee Train, and half a dozen romance novels with artwork that fairly sizzled. All manner of skin was being groped by gorgeous young maidens and their handsome lovers with impossibly flat stomachs. Each was by a different author, though all were written by Myra Beckwith. She would save those for later. Nothing she saw inspired her to pursue her own novel. She ate some granola as she flipped through Noel's book about the Marchbanks house. At 10:37, her cell phone buzzed, caller unknown. She barely said hello before a frantic, high-pitched voice declared, "We don't drink wine. I do beer, and Lee prefers rum. And the cabinet's stocked full, so you don't have to bring your own bottle. Welcome to the island. This is Myra." Mercer was almost chuckling. "A pleasure, Myra. I didn't expect to hear from you so soon. Well, we're bored and always looking for somebody new. Can you hold off till 6 this afternoon? We never start drinking before 6. I'll try. See you then. And you know where we are? On Ash Street. See you." Mercer put down the phone and tried to place the accent. Definitely Southern, maybe East Texas. She selected one of the paperbacks, one supposedly written by a Runyon O'Shaughnessy, and began reading. The savagely handsome hero was loose in a castle where he was not welcome, and by page 4 he had bedded 2 chambermaids and was stalking a third. By the end of the first chapter, everyone was exhausted, including Mercer. She stopped when she realized her pulse was up a notch. She did not have the stamina to blitz through 500 pages. She took Lee Train's novel to the deck and found a rocker under an umbrella. It was after 11, and the midday Florida sun was beating down. Everything left unshaded was hot to the touch. Ms. Train's novel dealt with a young unmarried woman who woke up pregnant one day and wasn't sure who the father was. She had been drinking too much during the past year, had been rather promiscuous, and her memory was not that sharp. With a calendar, she tried to retrace her steps and finally made a list of the 3 likeliest suspects. She vowed to secretly investigate each one with the plan to one day, after her child arrived, spring a paternity suit on the real daddy and collect support. It was a nice setup, but the writing was so convoluted and pretentious that any reader would have difficulty plowing through. No scene was clear, so that the reader was never certain what was going on. Ms. Train, obviously, had a pen in one hand and a thesaurus in the other, because Mercer saw long words for the first time. And just as frustrating, the dialogue was not identified with quotation marks, and often it was not clear who said what. After 20 minutes of hard work, she was exhausted and fell into a nap. She woke up sweating and bored, and boredom was not acceptable. She had always lived alone and had learned to stay busy. The cottage needed a good cleaning, but that could wait. Tessa might have been a fastidious housekeeper, but Mercer did not inherit that trait. Living alone, why should she care if the place wasn't spotless? She changed into a bathing suit, noted in the mirror her rather pale skin, and vowed to work on the tan, and went to the beach. It was Friday, and the weekend renters were arriving. though her stretch of the beach was almost deserted. She took a long swim and a short walk, then returned to the cottage and showered, and decided to find lunch in town. She put on a light sundress and no makeup except for lipstick. Fernando Street ran for 5 miles along the beach, and next to the dunes and the ocean, it was lined with a mix of old and new rentals, budget hotels, fine new homes, condos, and an occasional bed and breakfast. Across the street, there were more homes and rentals, shops, a few offices, more motels, and restaurants offering up bar food. As she puttered along, adhering to the strict limit of 35 miles per hour, Mercer thought nothing had changed. It was exactly as she remembered. The town of Santa Rosa maintained it well, and every eighth of a mile there was a small parking lot and boardwalk for public beach access. Behind her, to the south, there were the big hotels, the Ritz and the Marriott, sitting beside high-rise condos, and the more exclusive residential enclaves, developments Tessa had never approved of because she believed too many lights interfered with the nesting of green and loggerhead turtles. Tessa had been an active member of Turtle Watch, as well as every other conservation and environmental group on the island. Mercer was not an activist because she couldn't stand meetings, which was another reason to stay away from campuses and faculties. She entered the town and eased along with the traffic on Main Street, passing the bookstore with Noël's Provence next door. She parked on a side street and found a small cafe with courtyard seating. After a long, quiet lunch in the shade, she browsed through the clothing stores and t-shirt shops, mixing with the tourists and buying nothing. She drifted toward the harbor and watched the boats come and go. She and Tessa came here to meet Porter, their sailing friend who owned a 30-foot sloop and was always eager to take them out. Those had been long days, for Mercer anyway. As she remembered things, there was never enough wind and they baked in the sun. She had always tried to hide in the cabin, but the boat had no air conditioning. Porter had lost his wife to some horrible disease. Tessa said he never talked about it and had moved to Florida to escape the memories. Mercer had never blamed Porter for what happened. Tessa loved to sail with him, and she understood the risks. Land was never out of sight, and there were no thoughts of danger. To escape the heat, she stepped inside the harbor restaurant and had a glass of iced tea at the empty bar. She gazed at the water and watched a charter boat return with a load of mahi-mahi and four happy and red-faced fishermen. A gang of jet skiers set off, going much too fast in the no-wake zone. And then she saw a sloop easing away from the pier. It was about the same length and color as Porter's, and there were two people on deck, an older gentleman at the wheel and a lady in a straw hat. For a moment, it was Tessa, sitting idly by, drink in hand, perhaps offering unsolicited advice to the captain, and the years disappeared. Tessa was alive again. Mercer longed to see and hold her and laugh about something. A dull pain ached in her stomach, but soon the moment passed. She watched the sloop until it disappeared, then paid for the tea and left the harbor. At a coffee shop, she sat at a table and watched the bookstore across the street. Its large windows were packed with books. A banner announced an upcoming author signing. Someone was always at the door, coming or going. It was impossible to believe The manuscripts were in there, locked away in some vault hidden in the basement. It was even more far-fetched to think that she was somehow supposed to deliver them. Elaine had suggested that Mercer stay away from the store and wait until Cable made the first move. However, Mercer was now her own spy, making her own rules, though still without a clue. She wasn't exactly taking orders from anyone. Orders? There was no clear game plan. Mercer had been tossed into battle and expected to adjust and improvise on the fly. At 5 p.m., a man in a seersucker suit and bow tie, undoubtedly Bruce Cable, walked out of the store and headed east. Mercer waited until he was gone, then crossed the street and entered Bay Books for the first time in many years. She could not remember the last visit, but guessed she was either 17 or 18 and driving. As she always did in any bookstore, she drifted aimlessly until she found the shelves for literary fiction, then scanned quickly through the alphabet about midway down to the MS to see if any of her books might be in inventory. She smiled. There was one copy of the trade edition of October Rain. There were no signs of The Music of Waves, but that was to be expected. She had not found her short story collection in a bookstore since the week it was published. With a partial victory in hand, she wandered slowly through the store, soaking up the smells of new books and coffee, and from somewhere, the hint of pipe smoke. She adored the saggy shelves, the piles of books on the floors, the ancient rugs, the racks of paperbacks, the colorful section for bestsellers at 25% off. From across the store, she took in the first edition's room, a handsome paneled area with open windows and hundreds of the more expensive books. Upstairs in the cafe, she bought a bottle of sparkling water and ventured outside on the porch, where others were drinking coffee and passing the late afternoon. At the far end, a rotund gentleman was smoking a pipe. She flipped through a tourist guide for the island and watched the clock. At 5 minutes before six, she went downstairs and spotted Bruce Cable at the front counter chatting with a customer. She seriously doubted if he would recognize her. His only clue would be her black-and-white photo on the dust jacket of October Rain, a novel that was now 7 years old and had generated only pennies for his store. But she had been scheduled to sign here during her aborted book tour, and he allegedly read everything, and he probably knew her connection to the island, and most important, at least from his viewpoint, she was an attractive young female writer, so perhaps the odds were even that he would spot her. He did not. Ash Street was one block south of Main. The house was on a corner lot at the intersection of Fifth. It was old and historic with gabled roofs and two-storied gallery porches on three sides. It was painted a soft pink and trimmed in dark blue on its doors, shutters, and porches. A small sign over the front door read, Vicar House, 1867. From her past, Mercer could not remember a pink house in downtown Santa Rosa. Not that it mattered. Houses get painted every year. She tapped on the door, and a pack of yappy dogs erupted on the other side. A beast of a woman yanked open the door, thrust out a hand, and said, I'm Myra. Come in. Don't mind the dogs. Nobody bites around here but me. I'm Mercer, she said, shaking hands. Of course you are. Come on. The dogs scattered as Mercer followed Myra into the foyer. In a screech, Myra unloaded a, "Lee! Company's here! Lee!" When Lee failed to instantly respond, Myra said, "Stay here, I'll go find her." She disappeared through the living room, leaving Mercer alone with a rat-sized mongrel that cowered under a knitting table and growled at her with all teeth flashing. Mercer tried to ignore him or her as she sized up the place. In the air, there was a less than pleasant odor of what seemed to be a mix of stale cigarette smoke and dirty dogs. The furniture was old flea market stuff, but quirky and engaging. The walls were covered with bad oils and watercolors by the dozens, and not a single one depicted anything remotely connected to the ocean. Somewhere in the depths of the house, Myra yelled again. A much smaller woman emerged from the dining room and said softly, "Hello, I'm Lee Train," without offering a hand. "A pleasure. I'm Mercer Mann." "I'm loving your book," Lee said with a smile that revealed two perfect rows of tobacco-stained teeth. Mercer had not heard anyone say that in a long time. She hesitated and managed an awkward, "Well, thank you." "Bought a copy 2 hours ago from the store, a real book. Myra is addicted to her little device and reads everything on it." For a second, Mercer felt obligated to lie and say something nice about Lee's book, but Myra saved her the trouble. She lumbered back into the foyer and said, "There you are. Now that we're all good friends, the bar is open and I need a drink. Mercer, what would you like?" Since they didn't drink wine, she said, "It's hot. I'll take a beer." Both women recoiled as if offended. Myra said, "Well, okay, but you should know that I brew my own beer and it's different." "It's dreadful," Lee added. "I used to like beer before she started her own brewery. Now I can't stand the stuff." "Just gulp your rum, sweetheart, and we'll get along fine." Myra looked at Mercer and said, "It's a spicy ale that's 8% alcohol. Knock you on your ass if you're not careful." "Why are we still standing in the foyer?" Lee asked. "Damn good question," Myra said, flinging an arm toward the stairway. "Come with me." From behind, she looked like an offensive tackle as she cleared the hallway. They followed in her wake and stopped in a family room with a television and fireplace, and in one corner, a full bar with a marble counter. "We do have wine," Lee said. "Then I'll have some white wine," Mercer said, "anything but the home brew." Myra went to work behind the bar and began firing questions. "So, where are you staying?" "I don't suppose you remember my grandmother, Tessa Magruder? She lived in a little beach house on Fernando Street." Both women shook their heads. "No." "Name sort of rings a bell," Myra said. "She passed away 11 years ago." "We've only been here for 10 years, Lee said. Mercer said, "The family still owns the cottage, and that's where I'm staying." "For how long?" Myra asked. "A few months." "Trying to finish a book, right?" "Or to start one." "Aren't we all?" Lee asked. "Got one under contract?" Myra asked, rattling bottles. "Afraid so." "Be thankful for that. Who's your publisher?" "Viking." Myra waddled out from behind the bar and handed drinks to Mercer and Lee. She grabbed a quart-sized fruit jar of thick ale and said, "Let's go outside so we can smoke." It was obvious that they had been smoking inside for years. They walked across a plank deck and settled around a pretty wrought-iron table next to a fountain where a pair of bronze frogs spewed water. Old sweet gum trees blanketed the courtyard with a thick layer of shade, and from somewhere a gentle breeze settled in. The door off the porch didn't latch, and the dogs came and went as they pleased. "This is lovely," Mercer said, as both hosts fired up cigarettes. Lee's was long and skinny. Myra's was brown and potent. "Sorry about the smoke," Myra said, "but we're addicted. Can't stop. Once long ago, we tried to quit, but those days are history. So much work, effort, misery, and finally we said to hell with it. Gotta die of something, you know?" She took a long pull from her cigarette, inhaled, exhaled, then washed it all down with a slug of homemade ale. "You want a drink? Come on, try it." "I wouldn't do that," Lee said. Mercer quickly sipped her wine and shook her head. "No thanks." "This cottage, you say it's been in the family?" Myra asked. "Been coming here for a long time?" "Yes, since I was a little girl. I spent summers here with my grandmother, Tessa." "How sweet. I like that." Another slurp of the ale. Myra's head was peeled about an inch above her ears so that her gray hair flopped from side to side when she drank, smoked, and talked. She was completely gray and about Lee's age. Lee, though, had long dark hair that was pulled back into a tight ponytail and showing no gray. Both seemed ready to pounce with questions, so Mercer took the offensive. "What brought you to Camino Island?" They looked at each other as if the story was long and complicated. Myra said, "We lived in the Fort Lauderdale area for many years and got tired of the traffic and crowds. The pace of life here is much slower. People are nicer. Real estate is cheaper. And you, where's home for you these days?" "I've been in Chapel Hill for the past 3 years teaching, but now I'm sort of in transition." "What the hell does that mean?" Myra asked. "Means I'm basically homeless and unemployed and desperate to finish a book." Lee cackled and Myra guffawed as smoke streamed from their noses. "We've been there," Myra said. "We met 30 years ago when neither of us had two pennies to rub together. I was trying to write historical fiction, and Lee was trying to write that weird literary shit she's still trying to write, and nothing was selling. We were on welfare and food stamps and working for minimum wage, and, well, things were not looking too good. One day we were walking down a mall and saw a long line of people, all middle-aged women, waiting for something. Up ahead was a bookstore, one of those walled-in bookshops, used to be in every mall. And sitting at a table having a grand time was Roberta Dooley, back then one of the best-selling romance gals in the business. I got in line. Lee was too much of a snob, bought the book, and we made each other read it. The story was about a pirate who roamed the Caribbean raiding ships and raising hell and running from the Brits, and it just so happened that everywhere he docked there was a gorgeous young virgin just waiting to be deflowered. Total crap. So we conjured up this story about a southern belle who couldn't stay away from her slaves and got herself pregnant. We threw everything at it. Lee added, "Had to buy some dirty magazines, you know, for reference materials. A lot of that stuff we didn't know about." Myra laughed and continued, "We knocked it out in 3 months, and I reluctantly sent it to my agent in New York. A week later, she called and said some idiot was offering $50,000 as an advance. We published it under the name of Myra Lee. Isn't that clever? Within a year, we had a pile of cash and never looked back." "So you write together?" Mercer asked. "She writes it. Lee said quickly, as if to distance herself. We work on the story together, which takes about 10 minutes. Then she grinds it out, or we used to. Lee's too much of a snob to touch it. She'll damn sure touch the money, though. Now, Myra, Lee said with a smile. Myra sucked in a lungful and blew a cloud over her shoulder. Those were the days. We cranked out 100 books under 12 names and couldn't write 'em fast enough. The dirtier the better. You should try one, pure filth. I can't wait, Mercer said. Please don't, Lee said. You're much too smart for it. I love your writing. Mercer was touched and quietly said, thank you. Then we slowed down, Myra continued. We got sued twice by this crazy bitch up north who claimed we had stolen her stuff. Wasn't true. Our crap was much better than her crap, but our lawyers got nervous and made us settle out of court. That led to a big fight with our publisher, then our agent, and the whole thing sort of knocked us off our stride. Somehow we got the reputation as thieves, or at least I did. Lee did a good job of hiding behind me and dodging all the mud. Her literary reputation is still intact, such as it is. Now, Myra. So you stopped writing? Mercer asked. Let's say I slowed down considerably. There's money in the bank, and some of the books are still selling. I still write every day, Lee said. My life would be empty if I didn't write. And it would be a hell of a lot emptier if I didn't sell, Myra snarled. Now, Myra. The pack's largest dog, a 40-pound long-haired mutt, squatted close to the patio and dropped a pile. Myra saw it happen, said nothing, then covered the area with a cloud of smoke when the dog was finished. Mercer changed the subject with, "Are there other writers on the island?" Lee nodded with a smile, and Myra said, "Oh, far too many." She chugged the fruit jar and smacked her lips. "There's Jay," Lee said. "Jay Arkelrod." It was becoming apparent that Lee's job was to merely suggest so that Myra could then narrate. She said, "You would start with him, wouldn't you? He's another literary snob who can't sell and hates everybody who can. He's also a poet. Do you like poetry, Mercer, dear?" Her tone left no doubt that she had little use for poetry. Mercer said, "Don't read much of it." "Well, don't read his, if you could even find it." "I'm afraid I haven't heard of him." "No one has. He sells less than Lee." "Now, Myra." "What about Andy Adam?" Mercer asked. "Doesn't he live here?" "When he's not in rehab," Myra said. "He built a fine home down on the South End, then lost it in a divorce. He's a mess, but a really good writer. I adore his Captain Clyde series, some of the best crime fiction around. Even Lee can stoop to enjoy it." Lee said, "A lovely man when he's sober, but a dreadful drunk. He still gets in fights." Seamlessly taking the handoff, Myra jumped right back in with, "Just last month he got in a fight at the saloon on Main Street. Some guy half his age beat the hell out of him, and the police hauled him in. Bruce had to post his bond." "Who's Bruce?" Mercer asked quickly. Myra and Lee sighed and took a sip, as if any discussion of Bruce might take hours. Lee eventually said, "Bruce Cable. He owns the bookstore. You never met him?" "Don't think so. I can remember visiting the store a few times when I was a kid, but I can't say that I met him." Myra said, "When it comes to books and writers, everything revolves around the store. Thus, everything revolves around Bruce. He's the man." "And this is a good thing?" "Oh, we adore Bruce. He has the greatest bookstore in the country, and he loves writers. Years ago, before we moved here, and back when I was writing and publishing, he invited me to a book signing at his store. It's a bit unusual for a serious bookstore to host a romance writer, but Bruce didn't care. We had a hell of a party, sold a bunch of books, got drunk on cheap champagne, and kept the store open until midnight. Hell, he even had a book signing for Lee. Now, Myra, it's true, and she sold 14 books. 15, my biggest signing ever. My record is 5, Mercer said, and that was my first signing. Sold 4 at the next, then 0 at the third. After that, I called New York and canceled everything. Go, girl, Myra said. You quit? I did. And if I ever publish again, I will not go on tour. Why didn't you come here to Bay Books? It was on the schedule, but I freaked out and pulled the plug. You should have started here. Bruce can always drum up a crowd. Hell, he calls us all the time, says there's a writer coming in and we might really like his or her book. That means get our butts down to the store for the signing and buy the damn book. We never miss. And we have a lot of books, all signed by the authors and most unread. Lee added. Have you been to the store? Myra asked. I stopped by on my way here. It's lovely. It's civilization, an oasis. Let's meet there for lunch, and I'll introduce you to Bruce. You'll like him, and I can assure you he'll fancy you. He loves all writers, but the young, pretty females get special attention. Is he married? Oh, yes. His wife is Noelle, and she's usually around, a real character. I like her, Lee said almost defensively, as if most people felt otherwise. What does she do? Mercer asked as innocently as possible. She sells French antiques next door to the bookstore, Myra said. Who needs another drink? Mercer and Lee had hardly touched their drinks. Myra stomped away to refill her fruit jar. At least 3 dogs followed her. Lee lit another cigarette and asked, So tell me about your novel, your work in progress. Mercer took a sip of warm Chablis and said, I really can't talk about it. It's a little rule I have. I hate to hear writers talk about their work, don't you? I suppose I'd love to discuss my work, but she won't listen. It seems as though talking about your work would motivate you to actually write. Me, I've had writer's block for the past 8 years. She chuckled and took a quick puff. But then she's not much help. I'm almost afraid to write because of her. For a second, Mercer felt sorry for her and was almost tempted to volunteer as her reader, but she quickly remembered her tortured prose. Myra stormed back with another quart, kicking at a dog as she sat down. She said, And don't forget the vampire girl, Amy, what's her name? Amy Slater, Lee said helpfully. That's her. Moved here about 5 years ago with her husband and some kids. Hit pay dirt with a series about vampires and ghosts and such junk. Really awful stuff that sells like crazy. On my worst days, and believe me, I've published some dreadful books that were supposed to be dreadful, I can outwrite her with one hand tied behind me. Now, Myra, Amy's a lovely person. You keep saying that. Anybody else? Mercer asked. So far, every other writer had been trashed, and Mercer was enjoying the carnage, which was not at all unusual when writers gathered over drinks and talked about each other. They thought for a second and worked their drinks. Myra said, Got a bunch of the self-published crowd. They crank 'em out, post 'em online, call themselves writers. They print a few copies, hang around the bookstore, pestering Bruce to put him up front by the door and dropping in every other day to check on their royalties. A real pain in the ass. He's got a table where he puts all the self-published stuff, and he's always wrangling with one or two of them over placement. With the internet, everybody is now a published author, you know? Oh, I know, Mercer said. When I was teaching, they would leave books and manuscripts on my front porch, usually with a long letter describing how wonderful their work was and how much they appreciate a blurb. So tell us about teaching, Lee said softly. Oh, it's much more fun to talk about writers. I got one, Myra said. Guy's name is Bob, but he uses the pen name of J. Andrew Cobb. We call him Bob Cobb. He spent 6 years in a federal pen for some type of bad corporate behavior and learned to write, sort of. He's published 4 or 5 books about what he knows best, corporate espionage, and they're fun to read. Not a bad writer. I thought he left, Lee said. He keeps a condo down by the Ritz, and in the condo he's always got some young girl he met on the beach. He's pushing 50. The girls are usually half that. He's a charmer, though, and can tell great stories about prison. Careful when you're on the beach. Bob Cobb is always on the prowl. I'll write that down, Mercer said with a smile. Who else can we talk about? Myra asked, chugging. That's enough for now, Mercer said. It will take some work to remember these. You'll meet them soon enough. They're in and out of the bookstore, and Bruce is always having folks over for drinks and dinner. Lee smiled and set down her drink. Let's do it here, Myra. Let's throw a dinner party and invite all of these wonderful people we've been trashing for the past hour. We haven't hosted in some time, and it's always Bruce and Noel. We need to officially welcome Mercer to the island. What do you say? Great idea. Lovely idea. I'll get Dora to cater, and we'll get the house cleaned. How about it, Mercer? Mercer shrugged and realized that it would be foolish to object. Lee left to refresh her drink and fetch more wine. They spent the next hour talking about the party and haggling over the guest list. With the exception of Bruce Cable and Noel Bonnet, every other potential invitee had baggage, and the more the better. It promised to be a memorable evening. It was dark when Mercer finally managed to get away. They practically demanded that she stay for dinner, but when Lee let it slip that there was nothing in the fridge but leftovers, Mercer knew it was time to go. After 3 glasses of wine, she was not ready to drive. She roamed downtown and drifted with the tourists along Main Street. She found a coffee shop still open and killed an hour at the bar with a latte and a glossy magazine promoting the island, primarily its real estate agents. Across the street, the bookstore was busy, and she eventually walked over and stared at the handsome display window but did not go inside. She ventured down to the quiet harbor, where she sat on a bench and watched the sailboats rock gently on the water. Her ears were still ringing from the avalanche of gossip she had just absorbed, and she chuckled at the visual of Myra and Lee getting drunk and blowing smoke and growing more excited about the dinner party. It was only her second night on the island, but she felt as though she was settling in. Drinks with Myra and Lee would have that effect on any visitor. The hot weather and salty air helped ease the transition. With no home to long for, it was impossible to feel homesick. She had asked herself 100 times what exactly she was doing there. The question was still around, but it was slowly fading. High tide was at 3:21 a.m., and when it crested, the loggerhead turtle slid onto the beach and paused in the sea foam to look around. She was 3.5 feet long and weighed 350 pounds. She had been migrating at sea for over 2 years and was returning to a spot within 50 yards of where she had made her last nest. Slowly she began to crawl, a slow, awkward, unnatural movement for her. As she labored along, pulling with her front flippers and pushing with more power with her rear legs, she paused frequently to study the beach, to look for dry land and for danger, for a predator or any unusual movement. Seeing none, she inched ahead, leaving a distinctive trail in the sand, one that would soon be found by her allies. 100 feet ashore, at the toe of a dune, she found her spot and began flinging away loose sand with her front flippers. Using her cupped rear flippers as shovels, she began forming the body pit, a round, shallow burrow 4 inches deep. As she dug, she rotated her body to even the indentation. For a creature of the water, it was tedious work, and she paused often to rest. When the body pit was finished, she began digging even deeper to construct the egg cavity, a teardrop-shaped chamber. She finished, rested some more, then slowly covered the egg cavity with the rear of her body and faced the dune. 3 eggs dropped at the same time, each shell covered with mucus and too soft and flexible to break upon landing. More eggs followed, 2 and 3 at a time. While laying, she didn't move, but appeared to be in a trance. At the same time, she shed tears, excreting salt that had accumulated. Mercer saw the tracks from the sea and smiled. She carefully followed them until she saw the outline of the loggerhead near the dune. From experience, she knew that any noise or disturbance during nesting could cause the mother to abort and return to the water without covering her eggs. Mercer stopped and studied the outline. A half moon peeked through the clouds and helped define the loggerhead. The trance held. The laying continued without interruption. When the clutch held 100 eggs, she was finished for the night and began covering them with sand. When the cavity was filled, she packed the sand and used her front flippers to refill the body pit and disguise the nest. When she began moving, Mercer knew the nesting was over and the eggs were safe. She gave the mother a wide berth and settled into a dark spot at the toe of another dune, hidden in the dark. She watched as the turtle carefully spread sand over her nest and scattered it in all directions to fool any predators. Satisfied her nest was safe, the turtle began her cumbersome crawl back to the water, leaving behind eggs she would never bother with again. She would repeat the nesting once or twice during the season before migrating back to her feeding ground, hundreds of miles away. In a year or two, maybe 3 or 4, she would return to the same beach and nest again. For 5 nights a month, from May through August, Tessa had walked this section of the beach looking for the tracks of nesting loggerheads. Her granddaughter had been at her side, thoroughly captivated by the hunt. Discovering the tracks had always been exciting. Finding a mother actually laying her eggs had been an indescribable thrill. Now Mercer reclined on the dune and waited. The Turtle Watch volunteers would come along soon and do their work. Tessa had been the president of that club for many years. She had fought fiercely to protect the nests and many times had chastised vacationers for tampering with the protected areas. Mercer remembered at least two occasions on which her grandmother had called the police. The law was on her side and that of the turtles, and she wanted it enforced. That strong and vibrant voice was now silent, and the beach would never be the same, at least not for Mercer. She gazed at the lights of the shrimp boats on the horizon and smiled at the memories of Tessa and her turtles. The wind picked up, and she folded her arms over her chest to stay warm. In 60 days or so, depending on the temperature of the sand, the hatchlings would come to life. With no help from their mother, they would crack open their shells and dig out in a group effort that could take days. When the time was right, usually at night or in a rainstorm, when the temperature was cooler, they would make a run for it. Together, they would burst from the cavity, take a second to get oriented, then hustle down to the water and swim away. The odds were stacked against them. The ocean was a minefield with so many predators that only one baby turtle in 1,000 would see adulthood. Two figures were approaching at the shoreline. They stopped when they saw the tracks, then slowly followed them to the nest. When they were certain the mother was gone and the eggs had been laid, they studied the site with flashlights, made a circle in the sand around it, and sunk a small stake with yellow tape. Mercer could hear their soft voices, two women, but was safely hidden from their view. They would return at daylight to secure the nest with wire fencing and signage, something she and Tessa had done many times. As they walked away, they carefully kicked sand over the turtles' tracks to make them disappear. Long after they were gone, Mercer decided to wait for the sun. She had never spent the night on the beach, so she nestled into the sand, reclined comfortably against the dune, and eventually fell asleep. We have come to the end of the book hour and today's reading of Camino Island by John Grisham. The preceding program was a production of Sight Into Sound Radio.